The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. The clinical basis of the immune response and the complement cascade is presented by Dr. Brian Martin.
So, I have no disclosures, and our objective today is to pass the boards. So what I want to try to do in the next 30 minutes is to give you a framework to evaluate primary immunodeficiencies in adults. And we'll also look at the immune response, trying to use a case-based methodology. This is our primary immunodeficiency relative distribution. Notice complement way down there on your right. And notice how few there are, which means, golly gee willikers, what a great place for test questions, right? We all know that. So, our first patient seems to be getting a lot of infections. A 35-year-old female comes to see you with a chief complaint of, I'm sick a lot. She wants to know if this is normal or if there's something wrong with her immune system. Where do we start? I got five choices up there. Do we get the CBC, liver function test, immunoglobulins, and a CH50? Do we just give her some there and tell her to go on her way? Titers for CMV, mono, and hepatitis? Do we do a careful complete history or chest x-ray, CBC, and flow cytometry? We're internists. Of course we do a complete history. So that's where we start with the patient. So since all the other answers were wrong, because we need to get that good history first. History drives whatever else we do. So we have to know, how often do you get sick? What sort of pattern is there when you get sick? Is there a seasonal component? What kinds of illnesses do you have? What organisms have been identified when you've been sick? How severe? Were you hospitalized? What did you have to do to recover? Are there new exposures, new jobs? Is this a new teacher? So as we go through our history, we find out our 35-year-old female who says she's sick a lot goes on to say, whenever someone else in the family has something, I get it too. And she reports recurrent upper respiratory tract infection, sinusitis, bronchitis, and pneumonia. You've already got the answer to test questions right there. No organisms, of course, have been cultured. And she has no history of opportunistic fungal or mycobacterial infection. So what tests now do we order? CBC, CBC and CH50, CBC and immunoglobulin, CBC and flow cytometry, CBC and dihydrorhodamine. Well, in this particular case, we would want to know what her CBC was and what her immunoglobulin status was. Why? Because there are three rules that will help us determine specific immunodeficiencies. One, if the patient has recurrent bacterial otitis media, sinusitis, and pneumonia, like our patient does, we think about hypogammaglobulinemia. Two, a patient with fungal disease, protozoal, or viral infections, this is a patient who probably has defective cell-mediated immunity. And if we have a patient with uncommon bacterial infections and abscesses and bacterial infections that usually are we consider to be low virulence bacteria, that's chronic granulomatous disease. So that will help us out. We think this patient may have hypogammaglobulinemia. She's got recurrent sinus infections. So we know that this is a common form of adult immunodeficiency. The onset can be at any age, usually though 15 to 35. Like this patient, they have recurrent infections. Typically these are bacterial. And chronic sinopulmonary infections is what points us in this direction. Few problems with fungus, few problems with viral pathogens, increase in allergy and increase in autoimmune disease, and a normal lifespan is possible if they're appropriately cared for. So if we look at our answers and distractors, the CBC alone wouldn't give us enough data. CVID is not a problem of cells, it's a problem of antibody. So you have B cells, you just have B cells that aren't working well. CBC and CH50 is a test for complement cascade. CBC and CH50 are probably both going to be normal. It's the immunoglobulins that are going to give us our information. The B cells will most likely be normal. Total Ig and IgG will be low. CBC and flow cytometry. Flow cytometry is kind of the answer for everything these days if you live in an immunology world, but it's not the answer this time. Flow cytometry can give us a great deal of information about cells. This is a cell counting technique and a cell sorting technique, but it doesn't give us any information about antibodies. CBC and dihydrorhodamine test. This is another flow cytometry test, but it's specifically a test for NADPH oxidase activity to test for chronic granulomatous disease, or CGD. So the results come back in. As expected, the CBC was normal, but she has a low total immunoglobulin, low IgG, and her IgM is normal or low. This is most likely common variable immunodeficiency, or CVID. And the treatment should be replacement with IVIG or subcutaneous immunoglobulins. On the other hand, if our test comes back again with a normal CBC, a normal total immunoglobulins, a low IgA, and normal IgG and IgM, this patient would have selective IgA deficiency, actually a fairly common problem. It's not treated with immunoglobulin replacement. These patients will have a normal lifespan, and this is the most common immunodeficiency in American Caucasians. Again, this is one that these patients will have to be monitored. They may need some more antibiotics than a normal patient, but they don't receive IVIG. The specific test to find out if somebody has CVID is measurement of specific antibody response to vaccination. And we want to know that they can respond to protein antigens like tetanus and diphtheria, and that they can respond to carbohydrate antigens like Pneumovax or Hib. And what we do is we take blood samples, we measure the specific antibodies that we're going to immunize the patient with, then we immunize them, we retest in 4 weeks to see what their antibody level is, and we want to see a fourfold or higher increase in antibody level to the specific antigens we have used for vaccination. Failure to do that means that that patient's system doesn't work and is diagnostic for CVID. So we have a patient who doesn't produce antibody following specific immunization. We know this now is CVID. We have to watch these patients for chronic lung disease that may result in regardless of appropriate therapy. They have an increased prevalence of malignancies, they have an increased level of autoimmunity, and we treat them with IVIG at 100 to 200 milligram per kilogram per month, and then follow their peaks and troughs. If instead it was a selective IgA deficiency, typically this is an undetectable IgA. The IgA will be less than 5 milligram per deciliter with all other immunoglobulin levels normal. These patients are associated with allergies, recurrent sinopulmonary infections, GI tract disease, and autoimmune disease, but we treat these patients with antibiotics when they need them, and we just follow them. So those are antibody diseases. Our next patient is a 23-year-old with meningitis. So your patient's a 23-year-old male college student who has an unremarkable past medical history. He's been admitted to the hospital for meningitis. Lumbar puncture reveals Neisseria meningitidis. What immunodeficiency might this kid have? This is a very classic question. So, does he have hypogammaglobulinemia, selective IgA deficiency, terminal complement deficiency, ataxia telangiectasia, or chronic granulomatous disease? The most, given the paucity of clues that we have here, the most likely would be terminal complement deficiency. So if we go now to the complement system, all complement pathways converge at C3. So C3 cleavage generates C5 convertase, which results in C5B and C5A. We'll talk about C5A later because it's a wonderful anaphylatoxin. But C5B is going to sit there and call the terminal components of complement to itself. So it will begin the construction of the membrane attack complex. So the membrane attack complex is formed by the sequential fusion of C6, 7, 8, and 9 to C5B, and it ends up poking a hole in the side of the bacteria. Deficiencies in our terminal complement components lead to an increased susceptibility to meningococcal organisms such as Neisseria. So this is a perennial board favorite. And you can see our cartoon here of C5B sitting on the cell surface and creating around the attack complex. So if you see Neisseria as an infective agent or disseminated gonococcal disease, look specifically for evidence of a terminal complement deficiency. So our distractors: hypogammaglobulinemia, we've already talked about this. This is recurrent bacterial infections, typically sinopulmonary infections. Selective IgA deficiency, again, typically history is of recurrent non-life-threatening sinopulmonary infections. Ataxia telangiectasia and chronic granulomatous disease we'll talk about in just a moment. So ataxia telangiectasia is a primary immunodeficiency typically identified by two non-immune factors and has a cool photograph. If there's something that has a cool photograph, it may show up on the boards. So it's that simple. So they have ataxia and they have neurologic problems. Typically, these patients are wheelchair bound. And these telangiectasia, this is the classic picture that you see, is in the eye, but it can also be anywhere there's sun-exposed skin. But for the boards, if they're going to go off on something this detailed, I expect that photograph, because they're not trying to fool it. These don't bleed, they don't itch, they don't change. Chronic granulomatous disease. So chronic granulomatous disease is a phagocytic disorder. The phagocytes are not able to undergo the respiratory burst. The question that still vexes me from my primary boards was a question that simply asked what color the chemical turns on nitro blue tetrazolium test and whether yellow was good or bad. And we'll answer that before we finish this slide. I missed it, by the way. So who cares? They're going to tell me it's positive or negative. It's not going to say yellow or blue. So patients with CGD may be infected with bacteria that don't typically cause disease in humans, particularly catalase-positive organisms. They have recurrent bouts of infections. And what you'll see is pneumonia, but the big thing for CGD is abscesses. They're going to give you abscesses in the liver, abscesses somewhere in a solid organ, or abscesses on the skin, suppurative arthritis, osteomyelitis, and bacteremia. The diagnosis is based on the inability of these cells to undergo the respiratory burst. So here's our nitro blue tetrazolium test. The reduction of nitro blue tetrazolium to the insoluble blue compound by NADPH is what creates a blue color. Blue is good, yellow is bad. But typically the test that we now order is the dihydrorhodamine test. Normal phagocytic cells oxidize dihydrorhodium to rhodamin. So if we look at complement deficiency, the complement has a critical role in defense against bacteria, against fungus, and against viruses. It's most important in the very early stages of infection as part of our innate immune system, and it's critical in limiting an infection to the original site in helping to prevent dissemination, and then ultimately it helps to clear microorganisms from the bloodstream. And so here we see that our complement can help with lysis of microbes. We've gone through the MAC complex. It can help with inflammation. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. And it can create complement coating on microbes so that phagocytic cells can undergo phagocytosis more easily. It's like putting handles on the bacteria so that macrophages can pull them in more easily. So we have three complement pathways: the classical pathway, the mannan binding lectin pathway, and then the alternative pathway. The classical pathway is named like they name the hospital, all the buildings in a VA hospital. They're named in order they were discovered, not in order that they work. So we go C1, C4, C2, C3. And what it helps is to create an antigen-antibody complex on the bacteria. So IgM and IgG bind complement. Those are our two antibodies that bind complement. The mannan-binding lectin pathway actually is, it helps because the mannan-binding lectin binds mannose on the pathogen surface. So it begins by sticking to that mannan, and then it goes through MBL, MASP, C4, C2, C3. There's our old friend C3. And then the alternative pathway again binds to the pathogen surface, amplifies the classical pathway, and it goes C3B, B, D, C3. So C3 is the crossroads. And so although they initiate differently, all pathways converge at C3. Now the ABCs of complement, I actually really do like complement. A is for anaphylotoxin. So the A particle, the A part is gonna be the smaller part, and they're gonna mediate inflammation. So C3A, C4A, and C5A can all mediate inflammation, but the one they'll talk about and the one they'll test you on is C5A because it is the most potent. B is for binding, and the B fragment's gonna be the larger fragment. C3B binds to complement receptors on phagocytes and allows for effective opsonization. So it just helps our phagocytic system eat bacteria better. C5B associates with the bacterial membrane and forms the terminal attack complex, the membrane attack complex, and C4B is a weak opsonin. So remember that the complement deficiency stack was this little teeny thing, right? And we can have a deficiency in early components or a deficiency in late components. If you have a deficiency in early components, you would think that C3 would be the worst one because it's our crossroads. So C3B is this opsonic ligand, and if you don't have enough, you have increased susceptibility to bacteria for which opsonization is a primary defense mechanism. So this is strep pneumonia and H influenza. A C1, 4, or 2 deficiencies are similar to a C3 deficiency, but they're not going to be as bad. They're not going to be as susceptible to diseases as someone who's missing C3. The most common inherited complement deficiency is a C2 deficiency, and it is not common. The terminal component deficiency, again, is the one that they seem to love to test. C5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 form the terminal or the membrane attack complex. This attacks gram-negative bacteria and patients susceptible to gram-negative bacteria, and in Neisseria is the one they always like to use. Long-standing favorite question. Here's one that is interesting and, again, easily testable. We have a 20-year-old male who comes to us with a chronic fungal infection of his nails. He says, I've gone to a bunch of doctors about it. Yeah, and nobody ever does anything. My fingernails keep getting worse. They're ugly. I don't feel sick. I'm okay. I just have these ugly hands. Can you do something for me? And you look at his nails, and in fact, he has ugly hands. You look at his mucous membranes, and he's got some evidence of infection, a fungal infection on his mucous membranes. So what's our diagnosis here? Does he have a leukocyte adhesion defect? Does he have chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis, Jobe's syndrome, Chediak-Higashi syndrome, or Wiskalt-Aldrich syndrome? this guy probably has chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis. So this is a selective T-cell defect. Because we're internists and not pediatricians, we don't have to worry about the real bad T-cell defects because they are fixed or they die before they come to us. But this is a selective T-cell defect. His B-cell immunity is still intact. And this is associated with idiopathic endocrinopathies, hypoparathyroidism being the most common. And it can appear as late as the second decade, like our current patient. This is candidal infections of mucous membrane, skin, nails, or the vagina. They don't have systemic disease. And there are multiple phenotypes and genotypes for this, so you don't have to worry about that being a test question. If we look at our distractors, leukocyte adhesion deficit, or LAD, is a problem with the interaction between phagocytes and endothelial cells. And there comes in two forms. There's LAD1 and there's LAD2. There is an LAD3. Everybody's still arguing about it. It will not be on the test. LAD1 or LAD2 may be. LAD1 is the most common, and the leukocyte has a problem. The leukocyte is dumb. It doesn't have the leukocyte integrin CD11-CD18 complex. Who cares, you say? I'll show you in a minute why you care. This is an autosomal recessive problem. It lies on chromosome 21q22.3, which codes for CD18. LAD2, the phagocytes are normal, but the endothelial cells have a problem. And the endothelial cells don't express selectins. So our phagocytes have CD18, and they're perfectly normal. And here's why that's such a problem. The way you're going to get phagocytic help at a site of infection is through the endothelial cells. You know, those phagocytes are just whipping by in the bloodstream. But you need help down in the tissues. How do you tell the phagocytes in the bloodstream that you need help down in the tissues? You tell the endothelial cells to raise the selectins, to raise stop signs, and as the phagocytes go by, they begin to interact with these selectins. And so they begin to first slow down and roll, as you see here. It's like Velcro. They start getting a firmer and firmer and firmer attachment. Finally, they stop, and then they can extrude down into the site of infection out of the bloodstream. So that if you don't have the appropriate cell adhesion molecules on either the cell of interest or on the endothelial cell, you can't give that stop message. And our phagocytes just keep on flowing right by. So this is an order or a disorder of migration and adherence. In patients who have LAD, type 1 or type 2, you'll see extreme leukocytosis, 15,000 to 70,000 on just a routine CBC. And if they have infection, they're still sending the message that we have an infection. We need more white blood cells. So we create more white blood cells, but we create more stupid red white blood cells, and they can't get to the site of infection. So you can see over 100,000 count for phagocytes in a CBC in the face of infection. These are patients who don't create pus. They have recurrent bacterial infections. And this delayed separation of the umbilical cord, I put it in here because every book says it. That is such a non-discriminator. Spend no time with it. There are too many things that cause delayed separation of the umbilical cord. So if we look at phagocytic disorders, think about them in three ways. The first, of course, is neutropenia. We just don't have enough of them. The second is LAD, be it LAD1 or 2. We got tons and tons of them, but they can't get where we need them. And the third problem would be that we have enough, they can get where we need them, but they don't work. That's chronic granulomatous disease. So our second distractor was Jobe syndrome. Jobe syndrome is also known as hyperimmune globulin E syndrome. There are two forms that you should know about. I don't know that they'll get to this level of detail. They might. A STAT3 defect is autosomal dominant, and the mnemonic is faded. They have coarse facies. They get cold staph abscesses. They retain their primary teeth. They have increased IgE, and they have dermatologic problems or eczema. The other form is DOC8 defect. And a DOC8 immunodeficiency is an autosomal recessive form of Jobe's syndrome or hypoimmunoglobulin E syndrome. What you might get is a picture like this. Then these are all illustrations of people who have the characteristic faces of Jobe's syndrome. They have facial asymmetry, broad nose, deep-set eyes, and a prominent forehead with this kind of rough appearance and exaggerated pores. Distractor 3 was Chidiak-Higashi syndrome. I bring this up because it's got a great photograph that goes with it. It's a phagocytic disorder, recurrent pyogenic infections, peripheral neuropathy, but what you'll see is giant cytoplasmic granular inclusions in leukocytes and platelets on routine peripheral blood smears. So if you're given an immunodeficiency and a slide that looks like this, and you see the big granule there, then think about Chidiak-Higashi syndrome. Distractor 4 was Wiskalt-Aldrich syndrome. This is an immunodeficiency with thrombocytopenia, eczema, and recurrent infections. Thrombocytopenia is characterized by small platelets. It's an X-linked inheritance, and we have the WASP gene. We have an increased incidence of lymphoid malignancy and typically low IgM, elevated IgA and E. So we've now covered everything on those five areas. There's a final thing, though, that I think may very well be a test question, and that is graft versus host disease. So if you're presented with a patient who has had a transplant, you have to consider graft versus host disease. And the big thing is going to be between hyperacute and acute. Hyperacute occurs between 7 and 14 days. It's a maculopapular rash. It has rapid progression to what looks like toxic epidermal necrolysis and is associated with severe diarrhea. These people typically die. Acute also presents with a maculopapular rash. They also have diarrhea. They can have hepatosplenomegaly, jaundice, cardiac irregularity, CNS irritability, and pulmonary infiltrates. So this maculopapular rash can be in both of them, the way they start to give it to you. But hyperacute, 7 to 14 days. Acute, 5 to 47 days. Note the overlap. And that may be where they're going to ask you to distinguish. If it looks like TENS, that's hyperacute. And then chronic is just desquamation of skin, dysplastic nail growth, hepatosplenomegaly, and chronic diarrhea. So what we just went through was both the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. We covered epithelial cells, phagocytic disorder, complement, B lymphocytes, and T lymphocytes. And there are a number of potential test questions that can come out of that.